Federal National Mortgage Association versus Goodrich.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. This is a post-nonjudicial foreclosure sale that spanned the entire life of the NIDA brand rep decisions. It began the nonjudicial foreclosure sale before either of those cases had been appealed or ruled upon, and now argument is concluding after those opinions were issued last June. So the briefs have a variety of permutations that are no longer relevant in them. So at this point, I'll just discuss the relevant issues that have come forth based upon the June rulings in NIDA and Brandrup. The underlying trial court's ruling in this case was that the MERS system splits the note in the deed of trust, therefore rendering the nonjudicial foreclosure sale that occurred in that case invalid, and therefore Fannie Mae had no right to evict the defaulted borrower. The validness of MERS as the beneficiary has been ruled on in Brandrup and NIDA, as I'm sure you're all aware. But a few questions have been left open since those opinions were issued. The first being whether an agency relationship can exist between MERS and the servicer or the lender acting on its behalf. And the next is to what extent it applies to a completed trustee sale where the deed of trust upon sale has been recorded and we are now in the post-foreclosure eviction stage. And there are several reasons why in this case the NIDA Brandrup opinions do not leave us with the conclusion that the nonjudicial foreclosure sale in this case was invalid. The first being that this was a completed nonjudicial foreclosure sale with a recorded trustee's deed upon sale in the both Brandrup and NIDA underlying cases. There were prospective in which the default had occurred, but the nonjudicial foreclosure sale had not yet happened, and declaratory relief had been brought, as well as an injunction. In this case, we've moved to the next stage at which the trustee's deed has been issued, it's been recorded, and we're now moving to evict based upon that trustee's deed. Secondly, there was no proof of unrecorded assignments in the underlying case here. In both NIDA and Brandrup, there was evidence in the record of unrecorded assignments, but here the only assignment that was discussed at the trial court level was the assignment between the original lender, First Horizon, and MERS. So the trial court went into the discussion of MERS's validity as a beneficiary, only using that one lacking assignment as the basis for that discussion. But the Brandrup opinion holds that only formal assignments of the deed of trust have to be recorded, and assignments that occur by law when there's a transfer of the beneficial interest of the promissory note would not require the same formal written assignment. So there's simply no evidence in the record that that existed in this case.
Who does that cut against, though, if it doesn't exist? And you're bringing the claim below. You're the appellant on review. Why isn't an absence of evidence simply, why can't we view it as a failure of, if you will, meeting your burden?
Well, that would bring me to the next point, which is that in the post-foreclosure context, proof of the underlying foreclosure sale in an eviction case is not necessary or relevant. The trustee's deed in and of itself grants the evicting party the right to evict based upon the fact that they now hold title to that property. Because under Option 1 and Schroeder versus Woody, the court in an FED proceeding is limited to what it can decide. It could look at issues of title, but cannot look beyond that into the procedure in which the foreclosure happened. And that comes to the Chapter 86, 735, I believe, which grants that the recitals in that trustee's deed upon sale are prima facie evidence of the acts that occurred therein. So even if you're not a bona fide purchaser, you're still allowed as prima facie evidence to rely on those recitals, which is what occurred in this case. Finally, the judge's opinion in this case found that the fact that MERS had been a beneficiary of the deed of trust in and of itself rendered the sale invalid and a defect in the chain of title, and that's simply not what the court of the Supreme Court has ruled in the Brand Up and ID opinion. So to the extent that was the basis of his ruling, that's no longer applicable. So I will at this point reserve rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel, Jeff Campbell for the respondent, Kevin Goodridge. I would agree with counsel that there have been a lot of shifting sands on the legal landscape here, but I think that the main thing to keep in focus on is that this was a full completed trial. It wasn't on a motion for summary judgment like in the day. It wasn't on a motion to dismiss like in the Brandrup cases. We went to trial in this case. I was not there. Mr. Goodridge handled the trial. The burden, as Judge Wolheim pointed out, was on the plaintiff here, Federal Fannie Mae, to establish that they were entitled to possession. It's interesting that counsel points to the Option 1 Wall case on this point because it's essentially on all the facts that we have in this case. It also was a post-foreclosure case where there was a sale and a trustee's deed was issued. But the court, at the time of the FED, there was a challenge made to possession on the basis that the trustee's notice of sale had not been properly served. And this court found that that was the case because there were strict requirements for that. And based on that, it found that the purchaser, the grantee on the trustee's deed, did not have a right to possession. Contrary to what's in the statements in some of the briefing here, both post-petition at the trial level and before this court, there is no evidence that was presented that the trustee's notice of sale was ever served on Mr. Goodridge. So we don't even have a technical default like you did in option one. Apparently, if you look at, starts around page 22 in the transcript and continues on, counsel for Fannie Mae at the trial attempted to have the judge take judicial notice of several documents, one of which appears perhaps to have been the trustee's notice of sale, Exhibit 7, and also the substitution of the successor trustee, Exhibit 8, and an assignment from MERS to Everhome, Exhibit 9. The judge didn't do that. He said, if you want evidence considered, you need to admit it, and you need to establish a foundation. Thereafter, a counsel for Fannie Mae did establish a foundation for Exhibits 8 and 9 to the judge's satisfaction, and they were admitted. Exhibit 7 was never, the trustee's notice of sale was never offered nor received. If you look at the index at the start, you'll see, I think it's transcript 3, there is no listing of Exhibit 7 being offered nor received. So there's no evidence in this record that Mr. Goodridge has ever served with a notice of trustee's sale, which is the exact same
It is.
Situation.
But my understanding of Fannie Mae's argument on that point is that Mr. Goodridge did not put that at issue below, and the focus was instead on the MERS issues related to the validity of the nonjudicial foreclosure process.
I would say that he did put it at issue because he testified that he never received any other notice other than the notice of to quit. He was asked specifically about that. I believe that's at transcript page 21. So it was at issue in the case. And the judge refused to admit the notice of default and election to sell, which was Exhibit 6, because he testified that he didn't recognize it and he hadn't been served with it. So that was an issue in the case at the trial level. The other issue that I think is real significant here that is not addressed at all, we have no evidence in this record as to who at the time of the appointment of the successor trustee and issuance of the notice of default and election to sell, the issuance of the, if there was a trustee's notice of sale, the service of that, which apparently doesn't exist, the sale, no evidence as to who held and had a right to inform, to enforce the promissory note. The promissory note
itself. Excuse me. I want to make sure I'm understanding. You're saying there's no evidence in the record that reflects how the successor trustee wound up being successor trustee. Is that what you were arguing?
I'm arguing that there's no evidence as to who was the owner and entitled to possession of the promissory note. As a result, therefore, there is nothing in this record to support the appointment of a successor trustee, same situation that was at issue in the day after the Supreme Court decision. And there's also no evidence to support MERS assigning the beneficial interest and lien apparently under the trustee to Everhome, the lender, as apparent successor or attempted successor. They didn't put in the note. They didn't put in evidence of negotiation of the note, endorsements, all of which are extremely significant, as the Supreme Court has held, because it's whoever has the note that has the right to enforce the lien under the Trust Deed Act. And if you don't have that and you don't know who in the heck has that position, then you can't establish a basis for a proper foreclosure here. And it wasn't done. I would say that a portion of the judge's judgment in this case was overruled by the Supreme Court in Brandrup and also recognized in the day, and that was the lack of recordation of an assignment. I think there's been a misunderstanding as to the position that Mr. Goodridge took at trial. He had basically two challenges going on here. One was relating to this lack of recordation issue, which may not be applicable if there was no written, formal written assignment of the promissory note and beneficiary interest. The other was his argument that MERS was not a beneficiary under the trust deed, and that because of that, there was a break in title when MERS attempts to appoint or assign the beneficiary interest to Everhome. The assignment that I believe, if you review his argument, that he's referring to not being recorded was an assignment from the original lender to MERS, which would allow it to then transfer the beneficiary interest on to Everhome. So there was
Isn't the argument?
An argument that there was a break in the chain, which is the same argument that was made alternatively in the day that resulted in the day's affirmance of this court's decision on alternative grounds.
Are you saying that the problem identified below and that you're still asserting is that First Horizon could not assign to MERS? I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Where's the?
He was saying that there was no assignment of the beneficiary interest of the trustee beneficiary interest from First Horizon to MERS, which would then allow MERS to assign that interest on.
And what's your response to opposing counsel's argument that there didn't need to be an assignment because MERS was acting as First Horizon's agent?
Well, I have a couple of things on that. First of all, they didn't never raise that at trial. Their argument at trial was solely, and I can quote it, MERS was acting as beneficiary under the power derived from the initial deed of trust. And I think that's, page 12, maybe, TR. Anyway, that's what she said at trial about their legal position. So they took the position that MERS was the beneficiary under the trustee, had the power to appoint or assign the trustee. They didn't make any agency argument at all at trial. And the first time that ever appears is after this court's decision in the day when they file their reply brief, and then they raise it that they are the agent. But this gets back to that promissory note. If you can't show who holds the promissory note, then you can't show an agency. And there's no evidence in this case of any common agency under the MERS system and some of the other things that were intimated in the Supreme Court's decision in today that might allow, and Brandrup, that might allow an agency status. They didn't put any evidence on agency into this record. And unlike in Nadei and in Brandrup, we're dealing here with a trial. They were required to do it at the time of trial if they're going to argue agency. They didn't argue agency, and they didn't put any evidence in. So we don't see how they can make that argument now.
And what's your response to the argument that it's simply too late? It was too late at the point that the challenges were made here. It was too late, and that they had to have been made earlier before the foreclosure.
Well, that's why we think, first of all, the argument apparently is that there's a trustee that's been issued and there's this presumption of validity of all the underlying thing and so forth. That's a rebuttable presumption. And in this record, I think it clearly has been overcome because they never did show authority on behalf of the individuals involved. You know, I don't think if you have a person that declares a default, doesn't have any right to do so, has no legal authority, holds a trustee sale, and then issues a trustee's deed, you can't say that because that all occurred, that it was a valid foreclosure sale. There are certain substantive requirements that must exist to have a foreclosure sale.
Counsel, so I want to make sure I'm understanding your point. It's that there was this rebuttable presumption that everything was okay because it was final, but defendant raised the issue or presented evidence that, in fact, that rebutted the presumption and that the Fannie Mae never came back. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, the defendant raised the what was identified as the MERS defense, that MERS was not a proper beneficiary to engage in these things under the trustee, didn't have the power and authority.
So if you're sort of trying to rebut the presumption, don't you have to present evidence to rebut it? You can't just say, well, I don't agree with this presumption.
I think that the fact that the MERS never had the benefit of the promissory note, we don't even have the promissory note here, and the argument and the judge in his ruling was aware of the MERS system. There's been a lot of, I think it's almost judicial notice type situation here on what goes on with MERS. They're not a party. They're not a party to the note. They have no relationship. They're not a beneficiary. That's been established by the Supreme Court. Was also established by this court, and that was the principal argument that Mr. Goodrich raised.
Is your strongest argument in response to the it's too late argument your argument that Mr. Goodrich did not receive notice of the foreclosure sale?
That's one of them, but there's several substantive. If you look at Staffordshire case, you'll see that in that case they talk about substantive default defects in foreclosures that throw out the whole thing. In that case, it was a lack of a default. You can't go through a procedure if you don't have a default, and they had a forbearance agreement. But in Nade and Brandreth, we had an issue as to whether or not they could assign the beneficiary interest under the trust deed. That was a substantive matter. In the day, they also talked about they had to appoint the trustee under a valid successor trustee, because if you didn't have authority to conduct the sale, it would be invalid. That also was a substantive matter. There are procedural matters that I think the trustee's deed would cover. I think in Standriff, Stratford, they talk about the 10-day requirement for the delivery of the trustee's deed, for example.
Thank you. Your red light is on. Rebuttal?
There are only two issues I'd like to address quickly. The first is regarding this notice of the nonjudicial foreclosure sale. Both in the transcript of the record and within the judge's opinion, it states that the only issue was this proper, the propriety of MERS as a beneficiary. And secondly, with regard to the presentation of the note at the FED trial, I think we need to remember that the evicting party in this case was Fannie Mae. That was one step removed from the foreclosing party, even. The foreclosing party was Everhome by and through its trustee. Furthermore, a nonjudicial foreclosure sale doesn't even require presentment of the note, let alone a post-nonjudicial foreclosure eviction. At the point at which this FED action was brought, the sale had been complete and the note was absolved. The title had reverted back to the lender and then had been transferred by warranty deed. Presentment of the note was completely beyond the scope of the issues in this case and is simply not required in any action unless the basis of the judgment is the note itself, such as in a judicial foreclosure. So that rests.
I actually have one question. I didn't read Fannie Mae's opening brief as raising the too late issue. And often, if that's the case, that's a waiver in this court. Am I misreading the brief? And if I'm not, why should we consider that too late position?
My response would be that would be that I did not draft that brief. But it was, I think it was preserved below in the specifically within the post-trial memorandum?
Yeah, I agree it was preserved. I just didn't see it in the opening brief here.
It's referenced very passingly in one of the first paragraphs, but it's not discussed in length other than that. So you are correct. Thank you.
Thank you both. That case is submitted.